From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, the Reverend Jim Wallace, founder and president of the progressive Christian organization Sojourners, takes a candid look at racism and white privilege in a new book. And multiple Grammy winner Carlos Santana joins his bandmates from the early 70s for their first studio album in decades. But first, the battle among the presidential candidates for the influential Latino vote will be front and center in the upcoming Nevada primaries. Joining us now to talk about the potential strategies in both the Democratic and Republican contest are Thomas Sines, president of MALDEF, the nation's leading Latino civil rights organization, and Antonio Gonzalez, president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the country's largest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization. Before we do that, though, first a clip from last week's Democratic debate that's kicked up quite a conversation in the Latino community and beyond, for that matter.
When we saw children coming from these horrendously violent areas of Honduras and neighboring countries, people who are fleeing drug violence and cartel violence, I thought it was a good idea to allow those children to stay in this country. That was not, as I understand it, the Secretary's position.
With respect to the Central American children, I made it very clear that those children needed to be processed appropriately, but we also had to send a message to families and communities in Central America not to send their children on this dangerous journey in the hands of smugglers.
So to my mind, Thomas, that was the first time in these handful of debates that Democrats have had that this issue of immigration came front and center in a conversation. What was your reaction to it? And more broadly, what's been the conversation inside the Latino community?
Well, I think the Latino community is looking for immigration practices and policies that are fair and even-handed toward everyone. Mm-hmm. And what we saw with the Central American refugee situation was a lack of fairness and a fair amount of hypocrisy. So I think this is an issue that resonates with Latino voters and one that they will think about when they come to making a decision.
Agreed, Antonio?
Oh, I agree. The Central America crisis and the refugee flow speaks to failed American policies that go back through administrations. Not only the fact that in Honduras there was a coup in 2009 that overthrew a progressive government that was supported by the Obama administration while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, is part of it, created a failed state, a lot of extrajudicial killings, destabilized. The drug war is now in play in Central America as well, where you have not only Honduras, but Guatemala could fairly be characterized as failed drug states. So there's a lot of problems that deal with American policies that undergird this flow of really refugees.
And yet, as I see the numbers, Hillary Clinton still leads Bernie Sanders pretty significantly with the Latino vote as the numbers sit today. So how do you read that, Antonio?
Well, Hillary Clinton has tremendous name ID. Mm-hmm. And the Clinton's brand is deep brand with Latino leadership in particular across the United States. Bill was thought of fondly from his tenure as president, and so was Hillary. So it's common sense that she would have an advantage going forward. Mm-hmm. But Bernie's message has seemed to resonate more strongly than Hillary's message, and so it's a matter of time to see if that translates into more votes in the Latino community. I've just come back from Nevada, and what was a Hillary wipeout has now turned into an even race. Mm-hmm. And the Latino vote is about 15-20% there, 30% of the Democratic primary.
How much does it matter what happens in Nevada going forward where your community is concerned?
Well, I think Nevada is the first state that has a substantial Latino vote, so it's the first indication of how Latino voters may or may not mm-hmm. be changing their initial impulses. I think the Clintons, and Hillary Clinton in particular, has a longer history of knowledge and awareness within the Latino community. I think it's also important to note that the Latino community, like any other, is not going to make its decision based on one issue, whether that's Central American refugees or any other. There is an interest in having someone who's going to deliver across the board to serve the interests of not only the entire nation, but in particular of the Latino community.
So if Bernie can cut into that lead, Antonio, in Nevada, he's sort of even things up, but across the board again, Secretary Clinton still leads him with Latino voters from all 50 states. If Bernie can cut into that lead, what's his strategy for doing that? On what issues can he make a connection to Hispanic voters?
Well, immigration reform is the metaphoric issue in Latino politics today, just because of the context of the last 10 years, because of the demagogy of people like Trump that have spewed hate against Mexican immigrants and so on. But Latinos are also very sensitive to the class message that Bernie Sanders carries out because of their connection to Latin America, where class politics are much more prominent. Leftist party politics are prominent in Latin America. So the basis for resonating is there. And again, the comparison that everyone always uses to black politics are much more vertically or integrated, much more structured, much more intermediated, and more disciplined. Latino politics is a sort of a big sloppy glop. Mm-hmm. A lot of voters, and anybody can go around anybody in Latino politics. And so it's up to Bernie Sanders to take advantage of that or not.
Speaking of the comparison to black politics, this is slightly off the mark, but you'll take my point, Thomas. So Barack Obama shows up, 8 years ago, and when the Clintons think they're headed to the White House, he kind of upends the apple cart, so to speak. What would happen, and this obviously is being talked about everywhere, what would happen if Clinton were the nominee and Rubio were the nominee for Republicans? What would happen?
I think you'd still see a substantial majority of Latinos in favor of Hillary Clinton. I think that's because...
Even though they get a chance to make history.
Rubio is not a candidate who represents the best interests of the Latino community in terms of policy formation and policy implementation. And I would just say it's beyond the immigration issue, where sure, Rubio had been one of the leaders in trying to find a way to reach enactment of immigration reform. But it extends to issues like education, a critical issue for the Latino community. More than one in four public school students nationwide are now Latino. So really ensuring that the federal government takes a vigorous role in reducing the achievement gap faced by Latinos and African Americans is critically important. And we also know in the Latino community that these voting rights depredations that have been occurring in the last couple of years, particularly following the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County, are targeted more and more at the Latino community. That's the growing power. That's the growing vote. So the interest in suppressing votes is really about suppressing the voice of Latinos, and the Latino community wants to see that right to vote protected.
What are the chances, Antonio, that Latino voters tell pollsters one thing and go in the booth and think about it and say, you know what? This guy might not be right on all the issues, but this is our chance to really have a moment here, and I'm going to pull the lever for Rubio. Were he the nominee?
Well, I think Rubio would be an attractive general election candidate, and I think that if he was on either as VP or he's the president or VP on that ticket, that the Democratic nominee would have a very important strategic choice to make, and I think you would have to put a Latino on as VP. There are four out there. Julian Castro, the HUD secretary, is being talked about. Congressman Javier Becerra from Los Angeles, the number four ranking Democratic member in the House of Representatives, is out there. The immigrant rights champion, the Puerto Rican Luis Gutierrez from Chicago, is in the ether. So is Bernie Sanders' number one Latino, Raul Grijalva, who's the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus from Tucson, Arizona. The antidote to Cuban-American Marco Rubio, very attractive candidate in my view on the Republican side, would be a Mexican-American or Puerto Rican as VP on the Democratic side.
But the conventional wisdom at the moment, although I'm the first to say that conventional wisdom went out the window before the train ever left the station in this election cycle.
This election,
nothing is conventional. Exactly. So having said that, the conventional wisdom is that Trump may have a chance to run the table here, in which case it's hard to imagine that Rubio would be running with Donald Trump. So what happens,
Why?
Two
wings of the party.
How galvanized then, Thomas, would the Latino community be if Donald Trump were, in fact, the nominee?
I think tremendously galvanized. Donald Trump has made clear he is not really interested in courting the Latino vote. He's done everything he can to alienate that community by targeting it and demonizing it. And I think folks remember that. You can't run in the general election, we've seen historically, away from what you've said and what you've built your primary campaign around. And that's not only going to be a problem for Trump, but if Rubio were the nominee, I think he might have been an attractive candidate before this whole process started. But where he will be pushed to be as a part of the nominating process is going to hurt him if he ends up being the nominee as well.
I was respectfully, because you're my friend, Antonio, I was somewhat dismissive of your comment a moment ago. Dismissive because I didn't think you were serious. But while Thomas was speaking, maybe, I said, let me just back up. Maybe Antonio was serious. I can't see any condition under which Donald Trump and Rubio would run together. You think there's a possibility of that?
Absolutely.
Why would Rubio accept? That would be the death of him in his own community if he ran with Donald Trump.
I don't think that's true at all. I think that, you know, most voters aren't paying attention yet. I think that whatever happens in the primaries after June, people are going to tack back to the center on both sides. And I think you have a very real possibility of Trump as the Republican nominee. Yeah. You have to have that in the conversation. And they'll be looking to unify the party. So it's not logical, but what's logical about American primary politics to have this combination of opposites, given especially that Rubio's from one of the biggest swing state, Florida.
None of this means anything, Thomas, as we both, all three will agree, I suspect. None of this means anything if the turnout in the Latino community is not significant. So there are four states where the Latino vote is above 14-13%, so a significant slice. There are a number of other states where they're right around 5% where they could make a difference. Bob, give me your reasons to believe, at least, that we're going to see record turnout this time around in the Latino community.
I think there are a number of reasons, a lot of them still to be developed over the next several months. But you start with, the turnout has always improved during a presidential election. Mm-hmm. I think there's a recognition that the president plays a critical role in seeking to champion the issues and concerns of the Latino community. We looked for that with Obama, didn't necessarily get it, although the community did support him equally, if not more, in the second time around than the first time around. But there's going to be turnout because of the importance of the presidential race. I think there's also an argument that this in particular is the presidential election of the century, in part because of the passing of Justice Scalia and the chance for, if this president is not given his constitutional right by the Senate to put a nominee there, for the next president to seriously change the composition potentially of the Supreme Court.
Give me your quick take on the way this fight is playing itself out. We'll give Antonio the last word. I've seen a lot of wanton hubris on the part of the Republican Party. I have never in my life seen anything this hubristic ever. And yet, I digress on that. How do you read the politics on this right now?
I think that the statements of obstruction are ridiculous. I think they can't be squared with the Constitution. I think it's quite clear that we expect in the Latino community that the president who was elected and that the Latino community supported will be the president for 4 years, not 3 years or 3 years and 2 months, that he has the right and ability to appoint a successor to Justice Scalia, and that nominee should be acted upon.
Last word, Antonio.
Oh, I think, Tavis, back to your earlier point that we can expect a record Latino turnout. There's never not been a record Latino turnout compared to the previous election in 40 years, and we're looking at least 15 million registered voters, but maybe as high as, if Trump's on the ticket, maybe as high as 16 or 17 million registered voters and at least an 80% turnout. It's never been below. The 80% is the 40-year average. We could get 85% turnout of the registered. We have plenty of unregistered voters, 12 million out there, so a lot of work to be done, but there's the conditions, intense competition, hot issues, and charismatic candidates are all out there.
And Scalia?
Scalia, to me, it's insider baseball. This is the chattering classes issue. The Supreme Court has never been a mobilizing issue in electoral matters, so I don't know that it will be this time, but there's plenty of mobilizing issues out there, and we're going to see a very participative, very competitive election, I love.
Yeah. I think you throw out common wisdom and recognize that cases like United States versus Texas, Fisher versus University of Texas, Evanwell versus Abbott for the Supreme Court now, Latino community can be mobilized around this issue.
Two great leaders in their own community, Antonio Gonzalez and Thomas Sanz. Good to see you and have you back again, I suspect, in this cycle. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The Reverend Jim Wallace has long been at the forefront of progressive theological thought in the country. The prominent author, speaker, and founder of the Christian organization Sojourners has written 12 books, including two New York Times bestsellers. His latest text is called America's Original Sin, Racism, White Privilege, and the Bridge to a New America. Jim Wallace joins us now for a look at the impact of race on the presidential election campaigns. Jim Wallace, always good to have you on this program.
Blessing to be with you.
Good to see you,
always.
My friend. Before we jump into the text, I can't not ask you where this issue is concerned, racism and white privilege or these issues. What do you make of this presidential race? I deliberately don't want to color the question, pardon the pun, any more than that.
Well, the media is obsessed with
the race, the political race. Mm-hmm. We're going around the country talking about the state of race in America, not just the state of the race. And they're not talking about it. They're just not talking about it. So when you have a white nationalist candidate win the New Hampshire primary, we ought to be talking about that.
Mm-hmm. And that's New Hampshire. That's not South Carolina, Texas, Alabama, Mississippi. What do you make of that?
Well, the book talks about the bridge to a new America. The new America is that in two decades, as you know, will no longer be a white majority nation. Mm-hmm. Will be a majority of minorities. And there's a lot of older white folks who are afraid of that. And so that conversation is underneath all of this, on immigration, on a black president, on voting rights. And so that's the biggest political fact in America. So I talk in the book about how we have to build that bridge. A new generation, I think, wants to build that bridge to a new America, but the pushback is very powerful.
What do you make of the fact, and I'm not saying this to cast aspersion, I'm saying it because these are the facts and the data point this out, and every network has made this particular point, and that is that a significant number of Donald Trump's supporters, the white nationalists, as you called him, who won New Hampshire, are not the most educated Americans. How do you read that factoid?
Well, you know, we've had, as you know well, two kinds of populisms in America. Right. And the one is one that blames the other, Huey Long. So you got a lot of white working class folks now whose incomes are stagnating, whose sons and daughters are sent to wars that don't work and killing and maiming them, and they feel marginalized. And he's saying, blame the other. Mm-hmm. Blame the president, who isn't one of us. Blame the immigrants. Blame the Muslims. So that's the blame the other kind of populism. But the other kind says, no, after the Civil War in North Carolina, you had white working class people and former slaves forming a party together and electing a governor, two senators, a member of Congress. So that fusion party really worked. William Barber's doing that now in North Carolina. So there's two ways to do this, and coming together is the way that I'm talking about building a bridge.
What do you make of the fact that that Trump is winning in basically every category, we are told? Certainly that was the case in New Hampshire, including so-called Christian conservatives. Why are these Christians, these conservative Christians, so angry? I would like to think that one of the things that we work toward getting over as Christians is this sort of anger that's so deep inside of us. But what are these conservative white Christians so angry about?
Evangelical comes from the word evangel, which was in Jesus' first sermon at Nazareth, when he quoted Isaiah, said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to bring the evangel, good news, to the poor." Which means if your gospel isn't good news to poor people, it isn't the gospel of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so these folks are voting as white, older, uneducated Americans, not as evangelicals. So the book says if white Christians acted more Christian than white, black parents would be less fearful for their children.
Why is that so hard for some people to do?
Well, because their sociology trumps their theology. Mm-hmm. Trumps is a good word for that. Mm-hmm. So how do we, I'm talking to a lot of people who want to get theological. America's original sin was at the beginning of this nation. We said very specifically that black lives matter less than white lives. So we couldn't justify our faith and treat slaves as chattel property. So we had to say they were less than human. So a kid in Ferguson told me last year, "I feel treated still like three-fifths of a person." This is a teenage kid last year in Ferguson. It was in the Constitution, three-fifths of a person. So that was a sin against not just the Africans, but against God. God created us to be in God's image, all of us, and to have dominion, stewardship over the rest of the creation. Now, when one people says, "I want to have dominion over another people," that's a sin against God. So what I'm saying here is Christians got to get over their whiteness. White Christianity is an idol. Mm-hmm. So the book talks about getting theological here, going to the roots of this and saying we've got to repent of our white Christianity. And repentance, as you know, doesn't mean being sorry. Yeah. It means turning around, going a whole different direction on policing, criminal justice, education, economics. That's what this is about.
Yeah. I've read the text, so I know what you mean when you use the phrase America's original sin, but it reminded me when I first saw your book come across my desk, it reminded me of the much heralded race speech that Obama gave in his first run for office when the Jeremiah Wright thing mm-hmm. got too hot to handle. Philadelphia at the National Constitution Center. Mm-hmm. And he used that phrase, and I recall publicly pushing back on then-candidate Obama. And I pushed back on it because while I understood what he was trying to say, America's original sin is not slavery. America's original sin is, you well knows, what we did to the indigenous people. And while I take the point of the text and take what President Obama was trying to say, I just think we need to be a little more elastic in our definition of what we mean when we say America's original sin.
It wasn't original slavery. Sin was to dehumanize
precisely
people of color.
That's right.
First indigenous people.
That's right.
And then slaves.
That's right.
When whites get off with the slavery thing because I didn't have slaves, my parents mm-hmm. were slaves. No, it was, the Romans had Greek slaves. Mm-hmm. Who tutored their elite children. They didn't rip their families apart or make them into chattel property. The original sin was saying that white lives matter more than lives of people of color. Mm-hmm. That's the original sin.
How do you help those conservative Christians or just Christians, no matter what their ideological bent might be, for those American Christians who still don't quite get this notion of Black Lives Matter? They get offended by the phrase Black Lives Matter. What do you say to them? How do you help them understand that?
Black Lives Matter, the movement, is striking to the heart of America's original sin. So Brittany Packnett, one of their great young mm-hmm. leaders, I saw her the other night in Fur Ferguson. She says to me, we don't just need allies, we need accomplices. I love that. Mm-hmm. Accomplices. We're having town meetings all across the country. Mm-hmm. They're intergenerational, very multiracial, they're young, older people. And we're saying, what does it mean to be accomplices mm-hmm. for Black Lives Matter? This is right at the heart of the contradiction in American life. And the future here in Los Angeles, I mean, this is an epicenter for what the new America is becoming, right? So how do we build that bridge to the new demographic rather than trying to prevent, block, delay, deny the new demographic, mm-hmm. which is what is behind all this politics?
If inherent in your white skin is the notion of white skin privilege, whether one acts on it or doesn't think about it or not, there is inherently a privilege that redounds to you by the nature of having white skin. What does one do about that? One can't change one's skin. One can't apologize for being born white. What does one do about the inherent advantage that one gets just by being born white in America?
If you don't see white privilege, you got it.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm. So I wrote this book when Trayvon was killed. Mm-hmm. That's when I decided to write it. And I looked at my son Luke, who, know Luke.
Sure.
And he's 6 foot tall now, varsity athlete, playing baseball in college next year. The whole country knows that if Luke Wallace was in Sanford, Florida, same time, same place as Trayvon, doing the very same things, he'd have come back to me in joy. Trayvon didn't come back to his mom and dad, and he's not going to college next fall. And my son Jack, we're in the U.K. over the Christmas holiday. My wife's a Brit. They all said, Jack, you're so big and tall. And he's a big 12-year-old, right? He told them all he was 5'7½". Well, the news came over the pond over Christmas. The police officer who shot Tamir Rice was getting off. No trial. No indictment. And I read the prosecutor's words sitting next to my son on the couch. He said he was a larger-than-average 12-year-old. He was 5'7½". Jack Wallace wouldn't have been shot in 2 seconds without talking to him in Cleveland Park. That's privilege. That's mm-hmm. white privilege. I'm a white baby boomer. My naval dad veteran got an FHA loan mm-hmm. and a GI Bill, education and a house. That makes you middle class. The government made my white family middle class. So I'm talking in the book about how we have to understand this privilege. And so how do you make space? Because a new America is becoming, mm-hmm. and all these meetings around the country, we're having these town meetings, it's always young, diverse leaders who are talking about what does this mean here. We've been in Chicago, Baltimore, Ferguson, Los Angeles, up the coast here. What does this mean here, and how do we build this bridge where privilege or punishment are not the result of your skin color? Mm-hmm. Democracy in Black, Eddie Glaude says that, Black, brown, and white. That would be true American exceptionalism, which I've been critical of most of my life. So Heather McGee at the New York meeting said, Jim, if we could build that bridge to a new America and navigate these waters, that would be, for the first time, truly American exceptionalism. And I believe that.
The new book from Jim Wallace is called America's Original Sin, Racism, White Privilege, and the Bridge to a New America, with a wonderful foreword by Bryan Stevenson, who we all respect and admire. Jim Wallace, good to have you on this program, sir.
Bless you.
Good to see you, my friend. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Back in the early 70s, the band known as Santana released its third studio album, appropriately titled Santana 3. It was the final album recorded by the Woodstock-era members of the band until now. Carlos Santana is reuniting with his old bandmates for their first studio album in 45 years. It will be called, believe it or not, Santana 4, of course. And Santana recently released a single from the project called Anywhere You Wanna Go. Carlos Santana joins us now for his first conversation since announcing the project. The stage at Woodstock is a long way from the streets of Tijuana, man.
Yes, it is. Yet the commonality of both of them is the African music that I learned from Tijuana about, at that time they call it música tropical. Later on they call it salsa. But it's really music that came from Africa through Cuba or Puerto Rico or all the other islands. And to me, that music fascinated me as much as John Lee Hooker or B.B. King. So combining B.B. King with Tito Puente was, like, really exciting.
Yeah. How were you hearing all of this stuff in Tijuana? Where were you hearing this stuff?
You know, in the streets, some people were listening to Elvis Presley.
Right.
I wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, I would turn the dial and listen to something else that resonated more with the frequency that I am and
right.
that I have. I like romantic music, boleros, cha-cha-cha, danzón, cumbia, which is something that Charlie Mingus was really into. But I was really gravitating more towards, it's kind of like, even though Elvis Presley grew up in Tupelo, Mississippi, like John Lee Hooker, and he got, you know, all the movements and everything. But still, you know, I wanted to learn more where Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, and Little Richard got it.
Yeah. And you figured it out, obviously.
Yeah, I figured it out, yeah.
How does one go up? This is probably an impossible question, but let me ask anyway. How does one go about connecting with, I love your phrase, Carlos, connecting with music that speaks to the frequency that you are on, but finding your own voice in the process? I mean, everybody starts out listening to somebody. Everybody starts out copying somebody else. Mm-hmm. But eventually, if you're going to become Carlos Santana, you got to go from being a copy to being an original. How does one make that transition?
You have to know how to breathe.
Yeah.
You know, the secret of having your own identity from the Queen of Queens, Billie Holiday and Mahalia Jackson, to Marvin Gaye, to Louis Armstrong, they know how to breathe. If you don't know how to breathe, you sound like somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was our brother Tony Bennett who said, if you take from one person, it's called stealing.
Mm-hmm.
If you take from many, it's called research.
Yeah.
So I take from everybody.
Yeah.
And knowing and trusting that I know by the time I digest in, you know, whether it's Coltrane or Wayne Shorter or Herbie, you know, by the time I manifest this music through my heart, it's going to have my own fingerprints, you know, because I trust that.
When you look back on your career, and I had just a field day reading your memoir when it came out last year. I went that thing from cover to cover because I was so fascinated by the backstory of your life, which I want to get to a little bit if I can.
Sure.
When we get to this project as well, your new music project. But when did you know in your career line or on your career line, where did you know that you had finally developed your own distinctive Carlos Santana sound?
Oh, thank you for asking that question. It was like around 7 o'clock at night. And I was listening to the radio.
I love you.
You know, and I was in Marin. And, I was in Montemor Pius. And
right.
I listened, turned on the radio, and they were playing Samba Pati. And then I realized, dang, that's that's the voice of my mom and my dad and myself. And this song that from B.B. King and Otis Rush and Los Indios Tabajaras and Segovia, you know, but it's me. Mm-hmm. And I could tell that, like my father, I could tell a story that universally will be received. Because mm-hmm. that's what a real musician is. It's a storyteller. And you tell the story of and you remind people of their own forgotten song. Because mm-hmm. everyone has a forgotten song. Mm-hmm. And that you forget your song when you buy into the concept that you're guilty of sin and unworthy of God. Mm-hmm. That's when you accepted an illusion about yourself that is not real. Mm-hmm. You know? Because everybody is born with genius. Mm-hmm. They de-genize you. Mm-hmm. And they bamboozle you by making you into a wretched sinner or, you know, having so much poo behind you that all the toilet paper in the world cannot clean you, and only Jesus can do that, you mm-hmm. know? And you say, well, wait a minute. You know, I grew up like my mother, questioning everything.
Yeah.
Why am I a sinner? What did I do? You know? And so that led me to read more books like John Coltrane about Hinduism, Buddhism, and everything outside of Christianity. I love Jesus, but I don't buy into the guilt, shame, judgment, condemnment, fear. I think that's the Godzilla God. Mm-hmm. God is love. It's not Godzilla, you know? And the more I wanted to learn about John Coltrane and Mahalia Jackson and Martin Luther King and reading the Orantha book and other spiritual books, and then listening to Brother Bob Marley, Emancipation of Mental Slavery, that's what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. Break the chain of guilt, shame, judgment, condemnment, fear. Say to yourself, I am a beam of light that comes from the mind of God, and I am capable to create blessings and miracles.
When did you know, so you're getting deep with me now, as you always do when you come on this program, when did you know, or how did you discover, when did you accept that you were, in fact, worthy? As a human being, that you were worthy?
Oh, when Miles Davis would call me in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Miles Davis, Stevie Ray, Jaco, Wayne, Farrell. You know, for a long time, I was ignored at the Grammys, probably more than 30 years, you know, but my phone was ringing, mm-hmm. and it's Miles Davis. Hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, my God, it's Miles Davis. You can keep the Grammys.
Keep the Grammys,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I got my validation from, you know, Mr. Harry Belafonte and Mr. Miles Davis and Tito and John Lee Hooker. You know, John Lee Hooker gave me one of the highest compliments I ever had. He called me on his birthday, and he says, Carlos, I says, hey, hey, how you doing, John? He goes, man, when I hear your voice, it's like eating a great big piece of chocolate cake. Mm. And I was like, damn, John, you know, like, thank you for saying that, you know. So right now, you know, I identify so deeply with Ronnie Isley, because I just recorded an album with him.
Yeah.
And to me, Ronnie Isley and Aretha Franklin are like, when they sing, people cry. Mm-hmm. You know, they just cry. Like, at the Kennedy Center, about a couple of weeks ago, Aretha Franklin just took over.
At that Carole King tribute.
Yeah.
She killed that thing, man. I didn't even know she still had it that way.
Oh, you know, it was amazing to me. I started laughing because people are standing up, cheering, like, you know, because the Holy Spirit came into the room.
Absolutely.
That's the power that she and Ronnie Isley have. To me, they are the highest. And if I had my way, I would have both of them at the halftime mm-hmm. at the Super Bowl, because you don't need all that expensive nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, you need that resonant frequency vibration of chills, goosebumps, and people who make you cry when you're laughing. You don't need, when they're singing, you don't mm-hmm. even know why you're crying. Mm-hmm. But your soul does, because your soul is able to tell your mind, let go of the illusion story that you're not worthy. Mm.
You know, speaking of Super Bowl, so for the 200 billion people who saw the game, we all saw you. Wasn't long enough for me. But then it must have been the next day I was online and I saw a piece that you'd written offering your own sort of critique of the halftime performance. And you were expressing a disappointment that there weren't more Bay Area performers who had a chance to be on that stage while they were in the Bay Area.
Yes, because, you know, the Bay Area has given birth to immense bands like Tower of Power, you know, Larry Graham, Sly Stone, the Grateful Dead, you know, so many, many Journey, Santana, so many, Metallica, you know. And we can go over there and without all the other, as they say in the old days, without all the other expensive shenanigans, man, we can get it done, you know, because people need a spectacle of, for me, it's about, halftime is about the grandparents, parents, teenagers, and little children celebrating and validating each other's beauty through music. You know, if there's something about America that needs to grow up, because America is invested emotionally and financially in 17 to 27 only. And 17 to 27, as we all know, you don't know that much when you're between 7. You might feel a lot, but you don't know that much.
Yeah.
Like validation or humility, you know? Once you get to a certain age and you learn to really value and cherish, you know? So I would push more, and it was an invitation. It wasn't a critique to my sister Beyonce or Bruno or or a Coldplay. You know, it was more like, if you come to Houston next year, let's do a tribute to Brother Stevie Ray. And then show where Stevie Ray came from, which is like T-Bone Walker, you know, Albert Collins and Albert King, you know, and show an ocean of guitars, because guitars is what put America in the map, like Chuck Berry and Jimi Hendrix. You know, the more we see, I'm invested in guitars and drums because I really believe that presenting more guitars and more drums in schools. In fact, I want to have an agenda with Brother Damon John, Brother Spike Lee, and I want to be able to create a documentary about drums for guns. Going to the mayors through Kevin Johnson, Mayor Kevin Johnson, talking to the rest of the mayors and saying, can we have 10 in the morning to 10 at night and at certain days, congas in the park? And you can... You can fix it so people, when they come in, it's like going to the airport. If you have a gun, you can put it in there, you know. And we'll there'll be like 50 congas, and we'll teach you how to play. And if you like it, leave the gun, take the drum. Once we have enough guns, I want to melt them and create this beautiful angel of peace with an afro in congas, you know. So I have a dream like Martin Luther King, you know. And I really feel that the more we turn our sisters and brothers back into the drum, the less we will be fragmented, divided, and separate. Yeah.
You mentioned that when you're 17 to 27, you don't know everything and there's a lot to learn. So here you are now basically 45 years later, and you got the band back together for Santana 4. How's it feel 45 years later? What have you learned over these 45 years?
I learned that I was right. By seeking out, like a guided missile, the drum, the rhythms, melodies, colors, and textures from Africa. I learned that America could continue to set the tone for the rest of the world. Like, you know, like Michael Jackson is still forever here, you know. Bob Marley is here, and he came from the islands. However, the music came from Africa and also from Curtis Mayfield and the Doo-Woppers, you know. So I learned that I was right in the right path since I left Tijuana to learn about who's B.B. King's teacher, T-Bone Walker, you know, who's T-Bone Walker's teacher. Like that, you know, I want to know who's the teacher's teacher, and why is it that in one note, you make people cry and dance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Musically, when people get a chance to hear Santana 4, what will they hear, and how do you situate this project in the corpus of these other three, alongside these other three?
This is very it's a blessing to be part of Greg Raleigh and Neil Sean and both Michael Carabello and Michael Shreves, because there's the chemistry in there, you know, mm-hmm. just like the Rolling Stones, the Beatles. You know, Marvin Gaye is by Marvin Gaye. You know, he needed the chemistry with Berry Gordy and Smokey and everything. We all are part of teams, mm-hmm. you know, and this team with this Santana is very intact. There's immediate chemistry. As soon as we walk into the room, first note, we all play, and it's like, ooh, there it is. You know, there's a chemistry of Coltrane, Elton Jones, Miles, Coltrane, and Tony Williams, and Herbie and Wayne. There's a certain chemistry with certain musicians. This band has its own chemistry, and this band, whether it's like with Jimi Hendrix or Led Zeppelin or Cream, this band stands its own. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. What do you think? I'm going to ask you to set your modesty aside for just a second. So clearly, you've become iconic over the years. But what do you think that the band over these four projects musically has given the country? What do you think your contribution has been over the course of the work that you've done with the band, not solo?
This band validates what the United States is really about, mm-hmm. collective commonality. Some people call America fragmented fear, mm-hmm. because if you see everything that's happening on the news with police brutality and all the kind of stuff that's happening, you can call it fragmented fear, and you'd be right in one sense. Mm-hmm. You know? However, here comes Santana, and like Sly Stone from the Bay Area, you have music that blacks, whites, browns, yellow people, red people, everybody is like, hey, mm. we really are one family. It's not just lip service to say we're all one. Santana, because we came out at the same time from San Francisco, some of us were baptized with LSD. Mm-hmm. And when you take LSD, it's a whole other perception of, like a snake sheds skin. Mm-hmm. You're able to see why the music of Coltrane and Sun Ra and Alice Coltrane and why certain music like Stravinsky makes sense. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're not a square anymore. In the 60s, the worst thing you can call anyone was not the N-word or mm-hmm. any kind of word. It was a square. If mm-hmm. somebody called you a square, those were fighting words, mm-hmm. you know? But I'm not promoting LSD.
I'm about to ask you. That's not a commercial for acid, is it?
But I am saying, yeah. under the right supervision,
yeah.
it would help you let go of that toilet paper you got in your shoe. And that toilet paper is called a false illusion about yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, under the right supervision, you will feel...
You lose your inhibitions and your fears?
You claim your light in a different with a different tangible strength, mm-hmm. because you know some people just give lip service about this and that, but when you really live it, you know, like Jimi Hendrix, you know, I can tell you who took it and who didn't take it, yeah. who hadn't taken it, because their music, like it becomes all encompassing.
Can you find that? Have you found that? Without the drug?
Yes, because I learned to meditate.
Okay.
You know, I learned to become totally absorbed in the Holy Spirit through my Haley Jackson in the church or John Coltrane when he plays cosmic music, mm-hmm. Albert Eiler, certain musicians, Wayne, certainly, Herbie, Miles, you know. But if you have taken it, this music will even sound differently to you.
Yeah. My time with you is about to run out, and I hate this because I could talk to you for hours. But I want to go now to where I could have started this conversation. I've said many times, and I believe this, that we are who we are because somebody loved us. Every one of us is who we are because somebody loved us. It was impossible to read your memoir without coming away with a deeper and greater appreciation for your mother.
Yes.
Tell me about your mother.
My mother, I would call her supreme conviction. I have never known anyone who could just say like this, God's going to give it to me and God's going to give it to me. And we were like, uh-oh, there she goes, you know. Mm-hmm. And my dad had supreme charisma, but my mom, there was something about her that she just knew how to pull God's coat to get what she wanted. Mm-hmm. And what she wanted was not even for her. It was, mm-hmm. was for the family. Mm-hmm. So I learned from my mother about owning, believing in conviction, not wishful thinking. No, you know, mm-hmm. this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and God and I, we're going to will it to happen. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, you know, I wish I had that kind of a all-knowing with a tangible energy, you know. Mm-hmm. I have learned now that I am like her a lot, mm-hmm. you know, and I thank her because her prayers really, really work, man. I mean, I'll give you a quick example of what she would do. She would go to church and see, wait for everybody to be done in the evening, mm-hmm. and she goes to the priest. Hey, man, I got this bottle, you know, like Evian water. I want you to bless it for me. He goes, no, he says, the holy water is over there. He goes, no, I don't want that water. That's dirt, man. That's nothing but everybody else's sins and all that poison and germs. And I don't want that water. Bless this water.
Yeah.
And like, oh. So he would bless the water, you know, make it holy and whatever. Right. So then she comes home. When I come home, she, you know, she see me coming over. She put it in the hands and she start rubbing it all. Hi, mijo, how you doing, you know? And she's putting all this holy water on me. And I was like, Mom, you're getting me all wet, you know? Like, what are you doing, you know? But she had her own way.
She was blessing you, huh?
She just had her own way of believing that there was another way to keep the family intact.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't got lost. We didn't go to jail or anything like that, you know? Yeah.
So my time with you is up. How are you servicing this? You doing any touring this summer? But you're always on the road doing something. But what are you doing for the rest of the year in terms of playing?
Oh, thank you for asking. You know, my wife, Cindy Blackman, she's playing drums. She's in the band permanently and totally. We're going to go to Dubai. We just made a change. We have Brother Ray Green, singer from Tower of Power. Mm-hmm. We're completing an album also with Brother Ronnie Isley, just about done. We're going to do one concert here at Hollywood Bowl with Mr. Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock, Marcus Miller, Cindy, and myself.
I'll be there for that.
So, you know, we keep ourselves busy because we love creating.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to come back and see us and play for us.
Yeah,
bring your wife and the band.
That'll be my joy.
We'll make the room for you.
Thank you.
Love you, man. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
The new project from Santana, Carlos Santana, and the band is called Santana 4. We didn't get a chance to talk about this, but I went back to look at that first album cover, and I see how consistent you are.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. For those who are Santana fans, which means most of you, I guess, this brother is remarkably consistent, and you can take that any way you want to take it. He's consistent in his artistic genius. Love you, Santana.
Thank you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.